You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on April 28th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate, Greg, and I discuss the Israel-Palestine peace talks collapse, the Egyptian military dictatorship, and anti-Muslim hysteria. Then Daniel Fidler joins me to discuss Captain America 2. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio. You can also like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as usual, from Maryland is Greg. Joining me in studio is Nate. We're going to be talking now about the breakdown in the Israel-Palestine peace talks and then some of the aftermath of that. Not a huge surprise that they fell apart. That's been pretty consistent for the past, I would say, almost 20 years at this point of peace talks. A lot of people were pretty much expecting them to fall apart. But the interesting thing was that there was some political movement on the Palestinian side that was unexpected, which is what finally triggered the talks to break down. And then Israel gets to walk away from them looking like they're not the bad guy to their own side, basically. Everyone else, I think, still there's a pretty broad consensus that Israel messed up a lot of the talks by continuing the settlement construction and all that kind of thing. But the Israeli position was that there was a political deal that will probably be short-lived, but who knows, between Fatah or the PLO in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza Strip. Israel is willing to deal with Fatah and the PLO, and they pretty much have been willing to deal with them since, I think, the late 80s, but they have consistently not wanted to deal with Hamas because Hamas officially wants the destruction of Israel, although I believe that the PLO also used to. They just haven't given that up yet on the Hamas side. But Hamas obviously being the political Islam, whereas the PLO being the secular side of the Palestinian issue. And geographically, they've been separate for a number of years now. So Israel doesn't want to deal with Hamas, doesn't want to deal with a unity government. I think worth noting that the PLO is not exactly democratically empowered to make decisions on the behalf of the Palestinians, nor have they ever really been. Some of the deals that actually created the electoral system and everything in the Palestinian Authority in the first place were brokered between the PLO and the Israeli government, again, without any sort of input from the Palestinian people. Basically, Israel has had a habit of saying, these are the people we're willing to deal with, whether or not they're representative. These are the people we're not willing to deal with, even if they are backed by a lot of voters and whatever. And they just say, okay, if you don't follow these rules, then we're not going to have talks. So that's what happened this time again. And then there was leaked reports that John Kerry may have used the A word, the apartheid description with regard to Israel or the Palestinian territories, unclear at this point, and suggesting that there was an apartheid comparison there or that they were on that road. And of course, that immediately triggered all the upset from the American groups that support Israel pretty unquestioningly in a very hawkish position, as we've talked about previously on the show. Greg, I wanted to get your thoughts on this breakdown in talks and the overall situation with regard to Israel and the territories.
Yeah, it just increasingly seems, like you said, that I don't think anybody really thought that this was going to go anywhere because historically it hasn't gone anywhere. And again, also, as you said, it sort of seems like Israel is not really worried about brokering peace with the Palestinians as much as they are worried about looking like they're brokering peace with the Palestinians. So you deal with the people that you know are sympathetic or perhaps more sympathetic to you or more willing to work with you. So that in this case is the PLO. And you have them make decisions for all Palestinians everywhere. And then you say, look, we've made this agreement with Palestinians in good faith. And now because there is this radical Islamist, other Palestinian organization in Hamas that will not abide by this agreement that we have reached, then, you know, we're forced to do X, Y, and Z. And so it really just seems like all of the discussion and the talks that Israel has been engaged in with the Palestinians, or a subset of the Palestinian government, governing bodies rather, that is extremely self-serving and mostly a PR campaign. I think the United States is in large part falling for it. I don't think that the rest of the global community is falling for it. But as you said, there are people in the United States that will support Israel doing pretty much anything. I mean, I'm having a difficult time thinking about something that would be beyond the pale that Israel could do that people that are really, really Israel supportive would not be on board. Which is scary. And I'm not saying that they would do something that would be that egregious, that everybody would be appalled except for this really religious, usually subset of the American populace that is just sort of supportive of Israel no matter what. I don't know. I'm becoming increasingly despondent that there's ever going to be any resolution to this within my lifetime.
Well, so I think also to that point, I think a lot of people are concerned that, and this is, as I understand it, we don't know the full context of Kerry's comments, but according to his State Department spokespeople, he was actually saying that it would be an apartheid state if there was a one-state solution rather than a two-state solution.
Oh, okay.
And that would be, you know, that he wasn't talking about Israel now and he wasn't talking about the Palestinian setup or whatever. He was saying that if there was a one state, that it would be, which, like, I don't really understand what the distinction is there, just because, I mean, it's like a semantics distinction, because if you're essentially saying that the system that already exists would be solidified under Israeli control and that they would then be dominating the government in the way that the apartheid rulers did, although, of course, they have a much larger share of the population.
It's a fine distinction, Bill.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think that there are always these distinctions made, especially in terms of international relations, when you talk about, you know, how the United States government was reluctant to call what was happening in Rwanda a genocide, so they didn't have to intervene. And
right.
I think that this is another one of these buzzwords that is apartheid. And if we stick our fingers in our ears and pretend that it's not happening, then we don't have to do anything about it. But if somebody was to actually look at the situation and evaluate it critically and say, like, oh, yeah, this sort of looks like South Africa, then it would probably force some action.
When you and I did the soda water segment, I had brought up this point, but then I think I ended up cutting it for time purposes. But I had mentioned about this thing where the Israelis had set up a separate bus line within Israel between two points. I forget what it was, but basically for quote unquote security reasons, they had one bus line for the Jewish citizens and one bus line for the Arab citizens and the Arab Israelis, not the Palestinians. And that, I think it's a small example, but by definition, that basically is an apartheid system, because what apartheid means is that you keep everyone apart. That's the root of that word. But I think to my point about the one state versus two state solution and what is the situation now by default, I mean, if you look at the map, the Israeli settlements in the West Bank have metastasized so far that there's really very little left of the West Bank itself. It doesn't have territorial integrity, which in order to have a country, you have to have territorial integrity, and that's not something that they have. So I think at this point, a lot of outside people outside of this perennial let's go have some talks again process say, I don't think there is going to be a two state solution because there's no second state left to come into existence. It's basically going to be one big merge thing. And then the question is, are they going to be able to find a way to cooperate with each other? And I suspect that they're probably not going to be able to find a way to cooperate with each other, given that they have a very poor track record at the moment of managing relations with the Arab Israeli population, let alone the Palestinian population, as well as the Ethiopian Jewish population in Israel. They've shown a pretty bad record on that. And I think that's why if it does become a one state system, it is going to be kind of an apartheid rulership, which is going to cause all kinds of problems. Nate?
Bill, I'd just like to point out that you use the word metastasize and therefore compared the Jewish settlements to a cancer.
That's correct.
I would like to call you an anti-Semite for that statement.
So here are the insults that you can throw at me. Self-hating Jew. What else we got? I can't think of anybody.
Well,
else.
You're a Jewish anti-Semite.
Yes, that's right. I'm a Jewish anti-Semite.
But seriously, just reading the response by Abraham Foxman of the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, to Kerry's statement, I was actually a little surprised and a little disappointed because he didn't call him an anti-Semite. I was hoping for that. He did say, it is startling, deeply disappointing that a diplomat so knowledgeable and experienced about democratic Israel chose to use an inaccurate and incendiary term. Even if he'd used the repugnant language of Israel's adversaries and accusers to express concern for Israel's future. It was undiplomatic, unwise, and unfair. Such references are not seen as an expression of friendship and support. So, some good restraint not calling an anti-Semite there and really cheapening that term, which, you know, is actually a pretty serious issue. Going around willy-nilly calling writers and politicians anti-Semites does nothing good in the world. That's my opinion.
Nate and I are both from an area that's had some issues with the Anti-Defamation League in the past.
Not just that. Apparently, there are just like hardcore Likudniks that go to school committee meetings and get really upset and yell at my dad because apparently we don't teach our children to hate Arabs enough in our history curriculum in public schools.
I was going to bring that up.
A really big deal.
I was going to bring that up in the next segment. So if you'll just hold that thought, we will circle back to the local school committee issues of Newton, Massachusetts in a broader context of the next segment. It's going to make a lot more sense. But to go back to the Anti-Defamation League, what I was starting to say was that there's a large Armenian population in Newton and then neighboring Watertown. For our non-Massachusetts listeners, you know of Watertown as the place that bomber guy went to.
They got into the boat.
Yeah, he got into the boat. So that's the Watertown that we're talking about. But anyway, large Armenian American population there. The Anti-Defamation League, you know, has done some good works in reducing anti-Semitism and all that. However, they also have a very nasty history of denying the existence of the Armenian genocide. Basically, the known confirmed reason of why the ADL took that position, along with the Israeli government officially denying the Armenian genocide, was that until about 2005, 2006 or so, Israel's closest ally apart from the United States was Turkey.
Well, until they raided the Turkish ship and killed all those people on it. So.
Right. The relations...
That might have sabotaged relations a little bit.
Yeah, that was the ultimate breaking point between Israel and Turkey, but for a long time, they had been on the outs, you know, kind of declining relationship because of the Erdogan government and the AKP, which is the moderate Muslim government in Turkey, or formerly moderate, now increasingly extreme.
What's going on over there? That's a story for a different
episode. Yeah, that's for a different episode. But basically, the Israeli government was so closely aligned with the Turkish government and the Turkish military, which is very nationalistic and wants to deny their history of the Armenian genocide and all that. They essentially, all of the American Israel lobby groups backed up Israel's position of denying the genocide just so that they could preserve military relations with Turkey, which was a really messed up thing to do. So when the ADL guy is criticizing John Kerry for using the term apartheid and whatever and saying that, oh, he should know his history. Well, I'm sorry, but the ADL was trying to say there was no Armenian genocide for a long time. I don't know if they eventually changed their position because there was a whole controversy in Newton and Watertown about that. But, you know, Like we've been saying here, a lot of this is about finessing your language and these international relations things. At a certain point, aren't we going to just look at the facts on the ground or whatever, which is just, this is a messed up situation that keeps on getting worse. And obviously the Palestinians shouldn't be firing rockets at people. But if you just really think about it, if any other country were doing the stuff that Israel does on a regular basis, the United States would probably be putting sanctions on them. I mean, like
Russia.
Right. That, you know, they've, you know, immediately putting on sanctions on Russia, and, you know, you got your North Korea sanctions, etc. Israel is a country that, you know, worked with apartheid South Africa to develop nuclear weapons, and then
forgot about that for a bit.
Yeah, and then continually expanding the settlements, first as an intentional militarized housing policy, essentially to occupy by, you know, possession being 9/10 of the law, and then also creating a buffer of just having all these houses or whatever. And then it developed into this colonial thing. Even some of the origins of the Israeli state have a lot in common with colonial Europe. Grows out of this 19th century period in Europe. And even some of the Sephardic Jews who were living in Israel or then Palestine at the time were kind of being kicked to the side as the European Jews came in, because it was this sort of mentality of moving in and occupying everything, which, again, the Palestinians have also done many terrible things and blown up lots of people, and that's not good either, but that doesn't justify the Israeli response either, especially in recent years when the Palestinians have clearly been outmatched and have had essentially no support from any of the other countries. You know, it may have made sense when Israel was surrounded by all these major, regionally major military powers that were threatening them, but that is a long gone time period.
And more tank battles in the Sinai. You know, we just have asymmetrical warfare with Katyusha rockets and, you know, helicopters and SWAT teams from the Israelis.
Right. And at this point, Israel has developed the capacity to be able to just annihilate Palestinian communities from the air if any rockets are fired, which this is, the United States also does very problematic things with asymmetric warfare that are maybe disproportionate, as we've talked about on the show previously. But Israel basically attempting to colonize their neighbors with these illegal settlements and then throwing a tantrum when anyone calls them illegal settlements. I don't know what you're supposed to call them, but you can't just go build next door in these other areas. And we've stopped the policy of saying you can just conquer your neighboring areas. I mean, that's the whole deal we've got going on with Crimea right now, that those days are over. You can't just walk into the neighboring area and say, oh, this used to be ours and now it's ours again, and now we're gonna take control of it. And there was this period where Israel was willing to walk back from where they were on this position, but then the Israeli left got destroyed, and then all the hawks came to power, and then the United States went through a phase of having presidents that were unwilling to be critical toward Israel. And as I think we've said previously on the show, the best thing that Israel could possibly have from the United States is critical support that comes with being willing to tell you when you're messing up, rather than just rubber stamping everything you do or looking the other way or waiting until the last minute and being like, oh, come on, man, you guys shouldn't be building those settlements. Oops, I guess that's the end of the peace talks again. And then wait another 6 years to reinitiate them. This endless cycle is not helpful. And I don't see where the end point is at this point. And then Israel making deals for final plans of how the territorial lines are going to be drawn, or trying to come up with a final peace plan with people who were last elected in 2005 and they haven't had elections since then. I mean, yeah, there's, the United States also makes deals with various unelected guys who haven't been, but is that really what we're supposed to be promoting here? And then you get the Hamas coming to power and then Israel saying, okay, well, these people elected these leaders, but we just refuse to deal with them on principle. Dictating all the terms of everything and controlling the entire framework that happens and being totally inflexible about it and then throwing a tantrum if anyone says anything critical, which is why we don't actually talk about it that often on the show, because as Nate alluded to, especially around here, we're going to get all kinds of backlash for this basically. So
I enjoy a good shouting match on this topic. It's been a little rare recently, so just trying to return to form, you know.
All right, well, we'll be back in just a second from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. Still on the line from Maryland is Greg. In studio with me is Nate. I am your host, Bill Humphrey. We're going to be talking about Egypt. We haven't talked about it on the show in many months, I think more than half a year at this point, which surprised me. But if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com and you click that little Egypt tag, you will find many, many articles that I have written about Egypt in the past half a year or so. I think that anyone who has been reading it knows that my position has been pretty consistently clear that I'm very critical of the military regime. There were many people who defended the coup, even for, you know, a couple months after it had happened in July of last year. But basically, the premise of the defense was that it wasn't a very democratic system that they overthrew, and that democracy is about representing minority rights as well as the majority rule, and it's, you know, it's more than elections or whatever. The coup's central pitch that they made was that minority rights were not being respected, that this was being turned into an Islamist state, and that it needed to be overthrown. And then the United States, which loves the Egyptian military, basically backed them back into power, or tacitly accepted it and refused to call it a coup, which would have meant cutting off all the Egyptian military aid. Initially, I tracked on the show here on Arsenal for Democracy about how some of the initial promises weren't being met. And I think we might have talked about how there was that huge crackdown in which they killed hundreds, I think it was at least several hundred people, were basically mowed down in public by the Egyptian military. And then a lot of the focus kind of drifted away, but it's something that I've been watching pretty closely and keeping an eye on. And I think that it should be getting more coverage, because even today, I still read people saying, oh, well, we had to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood and the coup is better than the Muslim Brotherhood, which we'll get into that in a second, why I don't think that makes any sense. But it's important to remember that although it was, you know, a presidentialist transitional system that they overthrew last July, and that there wasn't a parliament or anything, and that there was problems of you know, suspending powers or whatever. The military and the military-backed courts were the ones who prevented the elected parliament from taking its seats in parliament. So the kind of system that was being criticized by a lot of people as a justification for the coup was actually the fault of the military, because they were intentionally trying to thwart the Muslim Brotherhood's rise to power. It was the most organized political party in Egypt. And then after the coup, they used the increasing attacks both in the Sinai and in the main part of Egypt by the Islamist rebel groups, many of whom are probably now joined by ex-Muslim Brotherhood members now that the party's been banned again. They used that as a justification for these crackdowns. But some of the things that we've been seeing out of Egypt have been getting progressively more and more insane. We've got this cult of personality developed immediately, as I talked about on an episode last summer, around General Sisi, who offered himself very beneficently to the people of Egypt as a president for life, should they want it. And he is probably one of two candidates or three candidates or something for president in the upcoming elections, but it's going to be rigged. His constitution was just approved by like 90% of the vote, you know, by ostensibly by the same electorate that heavily voted in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. So obviously you can see that the numbers don't really add up there. Other things that we've seen happen from the military, they recently claimed to the world media, the military claimed, even the civilian government couldn't get on board with this and was trying to argue with them. They got the entire Egyptian state media to assert that Egypt's military had cured AIDS. They just tried to tell the world that they had cured AIDS. I don't know why they didn't think anyone was going to fact check them on that, but obviously they didn't cure AIDS. Then, you know, other things that we've seen, reimposing virginity checks. So these were things that had been dropped under the Muslim Brotherhood government, which, you know, is not what you would expect from the Muslim Brotherhood if you're following the sort of U.S. like conservative propaganda about them, which we touched on a little bit last week. But basically,
well, they're coming to America, didn't you know, Bill?
Right. But the idea there, and this was endorsed at the highest levels by future President Sisi himself, basically that any time that any woman is detained or arrested by police as part of routine stuff, the police needs to get up in there and check to see if they're quote-unquote still virgins, which is a sexual assault, to be 100% crystal clear here. So at the highest levels, the future permanent dictator for life of Egypt saying that to protect women, police need to sexually assault them anytime they get arrested. Also, sexual harassment, which is notoriously bad in Egypt, has been on the rise again. A lot of the assaults and stuff that we saw during the secular phase of the revolution had died down a bit under the Muslim Brotherhood rule, and then have gone way, way back up since the aftermath of the military coup. A lot of observers have said that it is much worse to be a woman in Egypt than to be a woman in Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates right now, or one of those countries that are typically stereotyped as being much worse for women. And we've seen the state media people constantly banging that drum of why aren't the women being more proper and why, you know, it's their fault, etc. And I've written about this on the blog in much more detail, and I'm not going to go into it here for content reasons. But that's kind of the situation that we've been seeing on that front, and you know, kind of this endorsement of this culture of violence against women coming from the military. Now, I'm not going to say that the Muslim Brotherhood government didn't have problems. It certainly did, and it wasn't great on a lot of these issues either. But my question is, why is it that we're willing to say that one government is so much worse because it's a political Islam movement versus the military dictatorship? And to further really sharpen this point, I think it's worth understanding that the new constitution that was approved by the military was almost identical to the constitution put through under the civilian Muslim Brotherhood transition period, and actually had almost the same, if not stronger, provisions on protecting Islam as a state religion. The military was saying, oh, we're going to bring religious tolerance, we're going to bring this, we're going to bring that. In the past, you had an Egyptian military-led or dominated government. Typically, Egypt's military has been very hyper-conservative and very Muslim. The idea that they were somehow a secular protector of everyone in Egypt, was a fabrication. That was not backed by anything in history, and it hasn't been backed by anything they've done since the coup. So you've essentially got a system where it's a military government that is promoting a sort of military version of Islam, and they even have all these clerics that will come up with these special interpretations and say, this is how you're supposed to interpret Islam, and these are why we justify fighting these counter-terrorism campaigns and things like that. Which, it's all well and good to say that Islam doesn't endorse terrorism, but it's worth understanding that they have co-opted a lot of these clerics to basically come up with legal justifications or, you know, religious jurisprudence that backs up the military's position. So my point here is that we've essentially arrived at a point where you have a military government that promotes almost the same exact brand of Islam, but is somehow more acceptable than the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the parent organization of Hamas. But why is it that these explicitly Muslim political groups are somehow more objectionable than the Egyptian military Islam, which is not the same as the Turkish military that was explicitly secularist? So that's something that I, you know, that's a long intro, but that's what I wanted to talk about. Nate and I will talk in a moment about the situation close to home here for us, but Greg, I wanted to get your thoughts first on this Egypt thing, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the court situation.
Sure. So I think what's going on in Egypt right now, in terms of especially what's going on in the court system, can be described pretty much as a reign of terror. Right now, I think in the past couple of months, a total of nearly 1,200 people have been sentenced to death. So a couple of weeks ago, there were around 500 people that were sentenced to death. And then earlier today, there were 683 people sentenced to death. These numbers are ridiculous, obviously, but they belie something that's going on in Egypt right now, which is basically that, like you were referring to, there's this military government that's using all of these clerics to have their agenda upheld through various religious interpretations. The one particular judge that has sentenced the 1,200 people to death is probably one of the more powerful people in the Egyptian government right now, in that even if somebody is just assumed to be part of the Muslim Brotherhood, alleged to be part of the Muslim Brotherhood, too religious in the wrong way, they can be arrested, tried, and found guilty and sentenced to death.
Right, and to be clear, when they have done these bulk sentencing of giving out death sentences to 500 to 600 people at a time, typically those death penalties have been handed out on convictions for murder of one person in two batches. So there were two police officers that were killed in separate incidents around the time of or preceding the coup. I'm not exactly sure the timeline. And they basically, it was like anyone who was within a certain block radius of where this police officer was killed is now able to be sentenced to death for this one thing. Now, obviously, 500 people did not kill one police officer. But they're, as you said, they're using it as a reign of terror.
Right, exactly. And so I was listening to NPR earlier today, and they were talking to some of the relatives of those that were sentenced to death. And basically what they're saying is that, and this comes as no surprise, because there's no other way that you could sentence 683 people to death in 2 hours, but they're not getting a chance to defend themselves. Some of them are being sentenced to death in absentia. So, I mean, this is just totally foreign concept to due process that we hold so dear in the United States of America. Nothing like that is going on in Egypt at all right now. And now, granted, the previous batch of 500 people that were sentenced to death looked over by the head Muslim cleric to see if everything was up to snuff. Only 37 of those convictions and death penalties were upheld. And I say only in scare quotes, as if that's some sort of small number. The remaining 400 and so people that were sentenced to death, they will only be spending the rest of their lives in prison. So, I mean, it's absolutely out of control in terms of how the judicial system is being used to terrorize people that disagree with the government, that are alleged members of the Muslim Brotherhood, that, again, are religious in ways that the military government finds objectionable. And truly, truly, I don't understand why I hear about it on NPR, but it almost seems like it's sort of under the radar, like 500 people got sentenced to death.
Right.
683 people got sentenced to death. And it's just sort of like a number. And yet we had to realize that, you know, each one of those people is an individual person that has been absolutely railroaded by the military government, by the judicial system in Egypt right now, and it's terrifying.
Right. I think I agree with you that a lot of this is being swept under the rug by the U.S. media over here, which is why a lot of people aren't hearing about it. In that sense, that's been a problem for getting the word out, and I think that may be why some people are still saying, oh, well, this is better than the Muslim Brotherhood government. But the Muslim Brotherhood government, flaws aside, and there were flaws, and they had maybe some politically repressive things that were, but nothing on this scale. They weren't launching a terror campaign. Now, just for a comparison, I was just quickly looking up. The Tiananmen Square massacre in China in 1989 killed an estimated 241 to 2,600 people. And on the high end, that's probably more than the state terror campaigns have achieved at this point yet in Egypt. But that was well over two decades now. I mean, that's 25 years ago that happened in China, and people still talk about that and talk about the tank man and things like that. People have already forgotten that this U.S. military ally literally mowed down hundreds of people, just shot them up one morning last summer. I mean, that's mind-boggling. And then on top of it, all these other problems developing, this judicial abuse, these huge military crackdown campaigns on both the Muslim Brotherhood and the, you know, out-and-out Islamist terrorist groups in the Sinai. We've also seen the Coptic persecution campaigns. We've seen the violence against women rising. All of these things have been adding up under the military government. Oh, and these bizarre propaganda campaigns, like I said, about claiming to have cured AIDS and things like that. That's all adding up, and people don't seem, they're just saying, oh, well, it's better than the Muslim Brotherhood. So, Nate, you started to bring it up in the last segment, but, you know, I figured we'd defer it to here. Your dad was formerly a member of the school committee here in Newton, Massachusetts for many years. You and I both went through the Newton Public Schools and the history curriculum in the Newton Public Schools. One of my teachers, you know, your dad received a lot of criticism along with the other school committee members. One of my teachers received death threats over it. But basically, they are very agitated about the fact, not that they think that there's some explicitly anti-Semitic or anti-Israel curriculum, but that the curriculum is, if you really boil it down, that the curriculum is insufficiently anti-Muslim, that it's right. Not just that it's portraying the Palestinian side fairly or whatever, but that they're basically not teaching that Muslims are monsters and terrorists. That's kind of the objection here. I don't know if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I never actually got to go to any of the school committee meetings where some of these people were present, but yes, that's my understanding. It pretty much boils down to there's insufficient instruction in the history curriculum about, I guess, the dangers of Muslims and how their culture is seriously terrible. And I mean, all sorts of these types of things. And they got extremely heated and were basically yelling at the school committee at certain points. And I think at one point my dad told me he just had to walk out of the room because he just couldn't deal with it anymore. He didn't want to listen to these people. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty unfortunate that, I wouldn't say Newton is a diverse city, but I would say that there are people, especially in the school system, from basically all over the world. I mean, there's a decent Russian population, Asian population, whether it's East Asian, Indian, probably the one area where there's not too many Black or Hispanic students, but there is some diversity, and I would say, and there's also a large Jewish population.
And there's large pretensions toward tolerance and acceptance in the city.
Right. That sort of is a key message that is really hammered home throughout the school system, whether it's in the history department or wherever. And to basically take a hammer to all that and say, actually, no, we need to teach the children about how much Muslims are really bad. Never mind that there's about a billion things out there in our culture that really try to underline that point to a lot of today's children, whether it's in television shows, the way Muslims are portrayed in the media, Fox News, what have you. But it was really, really infuriating, and just the guile of some of these people to instruct how things should be taught to their children. I don't even think they had children in the public schools. They were older.
Some of them had children or people who had previously been in the Newton public schools, but a lot of it was
Well, maybe we should just put a piece in the curriculum about how much Jews are evil and they, you know, poison the wells and eat babies. And maybe we should just put that in the curriculum as well. Just, you know, point, counterpoint alongside with them. Just like teach the controversy, you know, is it creationism? Is it evolution? You know, Jews are evil, Muslims are evil. Just put them both in. And then we'll let the kids decide what's most correct. I mean, that's how we should do it. We should let them decide, use their critical thinking abilities. Just also put evolution in there and then some sort of creationism or intelligent design. Just, you know, just get all the different theories out there, teach them about UFOs and aliens and all sorts of stuff like that. Kennedy assassination, well, conspiracy theories.
To be fair, that was my 8th grade science class, so.
Well, but I'm talking about like the Greys. I'm talking my legit eighth grade, alien races.
No, my 8th grade science teacher was really into UFOs.
Okay, well, maybe that's a bad example. But this is not something that we should be focusing on. When we went to Newton Public Schools, we learned a lot about the Holocaust, I believe.
Like, all the way from early elementary school,
I remember we read,
I
forget the name of the book, but it's about
Elie Wiesel's Night?
No, that was in middle school. We read Night in middle school, but we read a more children-friendly version of a bunch of Danes who were, like, spiriting Jews away to Sweden.
Oh, right, yeah.
On fishing boats. So we read a lot about that, and just basically continuing on until you got, like, to the really brutal stuff.
Right.
And it just, we focus on this so much, and why should we... Okay, the point of the Holocaust instruction is to teach children that treating someone just based on a pure difference, whether that's cultural or...
Religious or ethnic.
Aesthetic, even, because, you know, it comes down to blonde hair, blue eyes, stuff like that, is fundamentally wrong. And just by demonstrating some of the brutality of the concentration camps, I think that point was really underlined. And then you're going to turn around and say, oh, actually, it's okay if we do really horrible things to Muslims because they're bad people. It's okay if we cut off their bus routes or put in settlements in their land or not allow them access to their own jobs and basically disenfranchise them, deny them certain basic rights because Israel does it and Israel can do no wrong. And everything that Israel does is totally okay and fine by us. And any sort of dehumanization that's in many ways similar to what the Jews experienced during the Holocaust, that doesn't actually matter because Muslims are bad and I guess they mistreat women or something. Do you hear about that?
That was an allegation that was made among many.
Oh, okay. Okay, interesting.
Oh, and also, not only all of that, which you're right about, but, you know, you mentioned about how much Holocaust instruction we had, which I agree is very important, and I, you know, we went through the same programs, etc. These people, some of whom were students who've literally been through the same programs like a couple years ahead of us, claimed to the school committee and to the media that there was no discussion of the Holocaust in our history classes in our curriculum.
I mean, that's just a lie.
It's completely, it's like opposite world lie, like they came from another dimension. It was nonsense, and it was all toward furthering this agenda of both defending Israel at all costs and specifically tearing down Muslims. And, you know, we've got Muslim students in the public schools who walk around and, you know, are having to put up with the fact that they're seeing the, you know, IDF shirts on the kids and stuff.
People at our high school would wear IDF shirts, and this was all around 2006, 2008, where you had the wars in Lebanon and also in
Gaza Strip
and all that stuff going on. And I remember just like my opinion of the people that would wear that just like would go down. It's like,
and
this is seriously something you want to broadcast to everyone? You think this was actually, I would note that more people went into the IDF from a high school than went into the U.S. Army. So there's that. But right. These weren't necessarily the same people wearing the T-shirts.
And our friend David, who has changed his opinions, fortunately, on a lot of this, but he used to not only wear the IDF shirts, but actually wear the Israeli Border Patrol shirts, which is, you know, even more notorious for basically shooting little kids who threw rocks or whatever. Like, you know, and you know, those folks, they're able to walk around like that and then have the audacity to say that their position is A, not being represented sufficiently in the public schools, and B, that there is some conspiracy to tear down Israel or whatever.
Can you imagine if someone wore like a Hamas shirt to school? It would be an international incident.
Well, I mean, no, people would wear keffiyehs to school sometimes, and there would be massive tantrums over that.
Oh, it's absurd.
Even, do you remember when Rachel Ray...
The Dunkin' Donuts commercial?
Yeah, the Dunkin' Donuts commercial, she wore a thing that wasn't even a keffiyeh, and they thought it was
like
and
a checkered
scarf.
It was a scarf.
Checkered scarf, and they thought that she was trying to destroy Israel with the power of her Dunkin' Donuts commercial. This is the community that Nate and I grew up in. We've been dealing with this. This is why we don't talk about this issue on the show very often.
This is just why we sort of have somewhat cynical views on the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict. After a while, you just get sick of all the stuff that just shoveled at you by people that really only want one side of the discussion to even be legitimate. Never mind. Actually, I think I once got into like a shoving match with someone because I said that Spanish was a more important language than Hebrew, just worldwide.
Which that's just a fact.
I mean, nothing against Hebrew, and it's kind of cool how it's been like brought back into a lot of common speaking.
But just so has Irish Gaelic.
Well, right. I'm just saying there are a lot of people that speak Spanish. You know, a couple continents. So just that's kind of relevant, but that sort of speaks to the. Some of the fault lines that existed, at least when we went to high school. Not sure how bad it is now, but just
it's not great.
It was pretty dramatic back in 06 and 08 just because of, you know, Israel's at war, and then they were removing people from the Gaza Strip, and, you know, there's all tank battles in Lebanon, all sorts of stuff like that. So,
all right, well, this segment's running kind of long, but Greg, you're an outsider to this particular debate, but I know that you've also done a lot of stuff with regard to Middle East peace studies at University of Delaware. You've also been to Dubai. I wasn't able to go on that trip with you. I was wondering if you had some thoughts on kind of the broader picture of this sort of American automatic antipathy toward Islam in you know, to the point where it's like denying the facts about the, you know, Egyptian government. Or whatever.
I think that once the USSR collapsed and there wasn't this boogeyman out there anymore for Americans to sort of be afraid about, that they needed something new to be afraid about. And I think that new thing was Islam. And I think that it certainly helped that people who are Muslim, or generally they don't look like, you know, people who are afraid of Islam, i.e. they're not white. Which is not to say that all Muslims are people of color. That's totally not true. But I think that it was very easy to sort of portray Muslims as the other. And I think that's been the case for probably my entire life, because I was born right before the official collapse of the Soviet Union. It's troubling to me, obviously, that there are a lot of people, I think, in the United States of America that talk about how there are people in the Muslim community overseas that have been indoctrinated to an extent that they think that all Jews are bad or all Americans are bad or this or that, and that they're not cognizant of the fact that this is the same thing that's going on here. And I think that that is certainly something that needs to change. And I think that, you know, I applaud people in Newton for standing up to that. I think that Bill posted something the other day that said, you know, 428 students were signatories to this letter that they sent to all of these people that were rallying about how anti-Semitic and anti-Israel this curriculum was, and basically just said, no, this is okay, and you know, we're learning, and you just need to back off. Right. I think that that conversation needs to happen more often. I think that students need to be empowered to have that conversation, because, you know, if we keep force feeding our kids these boogeyman nightmares about the other and they're getting the same thing about us, then certainly we're never going to come to any resolution and have any peace. So I don't know what necessarily is the step to take on a broad scale or broader scale than what the students at Newton South High School have done in order to stand up to these people. I think it's a good start. It's really difficult. I think that I've been lucky that I've been involved in a lot of different programs, like Bill was alluding to, that have shown me both sides of this situation. I mean, I'm Jewish, and I have a lot of friends that are Orthodox Jews, and I have a lot of friends that are Orthodox Jews that live in Israel. And then at the same time, I had the opportunity to go to Dubai, and I also had the opportunity to work on the Middle Eastern Partnership Initiative. And I think that it really opened up my eyes to a lot of the things that I sort of had in terms of preconceived notions about what I thought a Muslim was, or what I thought, you know, necessarily a Jew was too. So, and I think that the more people that understand other people in flesh and blood, and not just sort of as these abstract concepts, the less you'll see of these sort of misunderstandings about history curriculums and settlements that are illegal and whatnot. But I think that it's certainly a hard road.
And I think that, you know, it's important to teach the stuff about the Holocaust. But as Nate said, you've got to have that context about why are we learning this? Not just, oh, there are a lot of Jewish people in our town, so that's why we're learning it. There has to be a context of this is important because, and tells us something broader about our society this way. And you mentioned about the sort of U.S. perspective since the end of the Cold War. But of course, in addition to teaching the Holocaust, why are we not teaching about older anti-Jewish persecutions in Europe? Why are we not teaching about the long history of anti-Muslim persecutions, especially by European powers? You've got, you know, your massacres in Nigeria, in colonial Algeria, in, you know, Afghanistan with the Spain. Communist terror, the situation in Spain, you've got the Chechen massacres, you've got the Circassian deportations, all of these things. In terms of modern Europe, there's as long a history, definitely, of these anti-Muslim persecutions as there are of these anti-Jewish persecutions. Let's learn about all these things. Let's approach this with a little bit more rationality and an eye toward history. Well, we've really got to wrap this up now, but Nate, thank you so much for joining me here in studio again.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And Greg, on the line from Maryland, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a second from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD. I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me in studio this week for a pop culture political segment is Dan Fidler. You can follow him at
Daniel_Fidler
on Twitter and get more of his insights there on various movies and TV shows and other great things in culture. Obviously, he doesn't just focus on political stuff, but this is a political show. In this particular segment, we're going to be talking about Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier. We've given folks a few weeks to go see it in theaters, but if you still haven't seen it yet and you don't know what happens and you don't want it spoiled, now would be a good time to turn off the show. This is going to be the last segment in the show, so you can skip to the top of the hour if you're listening on the radio, or just turn it off if you're listening on your podcast, and that way you won't get anything spoiled and you won't miss anything else in the show. So with that big spoiler warning out of the way, we're going to be talking about Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier. Before we get into the, you know, political side of it, Dan, what were your general thoughts on this movie?
I thought it was great. Way better than the first Captain America. Probably one of my favorite films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, I thought that the first one had a lot of cinematography issues in that, like, they were always really close to the action and you couldn't see what was happening. And I liked that the opening sequence in the second one was they're trying to take, what, a tanker ship or something. And so they show lots of shots of Captain America, like, running along the side of the ship, which meant that I could actually follow what was happening because I could see they had establishing shots, basically.
Right.
So I liked that part. What were some other elements that you thought really worked in this film?
Definitely plot. The action sequences were not hard to follow, which was good. Anthony Mackie as the Falcon kind of stole the movie for me. And I liked the relationship or non-relationship between Cap and Natasha, the Black Widow.
Right. I was describing it off air to you as a cross-gender bromance in that it was a non-romantic relationship, but they were, you know, clearly very affectionate toward each other. You know, in terms of classifying plots, this is a very classic, our huge organization has been brought down from within and therefore we have to go on the run and we can't trust anyone. That's like the gist of this kind of movie. And so he gets to spend a lot of time, Captain America gets to spend a lot of time with the Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff character played by Scarlett Johansson, but they're not having a romantic relationship. There's not much like hinting in that direction or will they, won't they type of thing, which I thought was a nice change. In continuing with this sort of awesome, strong female character that Joss Whedon had really, you know, developed, I think, a lot in the Avengers movie, although she had appeared in the other ones, this was a continuation of that, like giving her more dimensionality than just saying, oh, this is the secondary female sidekick who's gonna be falling in love with. He obviously, Captain America has superhuman strength and that kind of thing, so he does have to, you know, save her periodically, but she's also doing a ton of stuff to save him. So I thought that was a much more balanced relationship than we usually get to see. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Any other elements that you wanted to talk about in particular in this movie that really stood out for you?
Just the spy espionage bit of it. It was like a political thriller, which I enjoyed, even though politics is not my forte. It is your forte. I liked Sharon, the character that was like his, lived down the
Oh, yes, apartment. The Emily Van Camp character. Yeah.
The one that Natasha kept trying to team him up with
right. For
a date. Hopefully that goes somewhere in the third movie because I like Emily Van Camp.
I'm a big Sebastian Stan fan, despite some of the issues that he's had in some of his other characters, whatever. He's also someone who's been in a lot of political dramas. He was the Prince on Kings on NBC, the one season show. That was where I first got really into him. He was also one of Sons on the USA Network, Political Animals. Yeah. So Sebastian Stan's been in a lot of these political dramas. I thought this was a very unusual character for him. He's sort of playing this brainwashed former Soviet, partly mechanized super assassin. What did you think of his portrayal in this movie?
Well, it was very different from his portrayal in the first Captain America movie, obviously. He kind of just acted as a action villain bad guy until, well, we already put the spoiler alert out, so till the very end when
he starts to try to figure out who he is, essentially. Yeah.
So, I mean, the way that the post-credits scene indicated, it seems to me that we're getting more Sebastian Stan in the third Captain America.
Which is only a good thing in my
mind. Right, book. So I hope that they develop his new version of himself further there.
All right, well, you mentioned this is a political drama. That's the, you know, central focus of the plot. So that's obviously why we've got you on to talk about the movie today here on Arsenal for Democracy. So we're going to play a clip. Again, if you missed the earlier spoiler warning, definitely a spoiler warning because we're playing something from basically the big reveal of the movie. This is a short clip from Arnim Zola's sort of revelation in when they're in the ye olde bunker with the ye olde computers in New Jersey. So he's kind of telling about, he's the former Hydra guy from the first movie, and he's telling about what Hydra did after it was quote-unquote defeated in World War II, and what it's been doing, you know, with relation to S.H.I.E.L.D. And of course, the backdrop to all of this is that Captain America has found out that there is this Project Insight that S.H.I.E.L.D. has been working on, and they're gonna put these huge hovering aircraft carrier things in the sky that can shoot millions of people
at
one time, and so they could kill 3 million people in a very short span. And the premise of this, of course, was that they were doing it to eliminate threats in one big go and therefore make the world safer. So a lot of that theme of the movie is obviously whether or not the ends, security, justify the means, and also what kind of security do we actually want. So let's take a listen to that clip.
Accessing archive. Hydra was founded on the belief that humanity could not be trusted with its own freedom. What we did not realize was that if you try to take that freedom, they resist. The war taught us much. Humanity needed to surrender its freedom willingly. After the war, S.H.I.E.L.D. was founded, and I was recruited. The new Hydra grew, a beautiful parasite inside S.H.I.E.L.D. For 70 years, Hydra has been secretly feeding crisis, reaping war. And when history did not cooperate, history was changed. Hydra created a world so chaotic that humanity is finally ready to sacrifice its freedom to gain its security.
Hail Hydra.
Obviously, the theme of that clip and the theme of the movie is, are people too willing to surrender their freedoms because they've kind of been scared into it? Hydra's alleged goal was to sow all this chaos in the world, and then people would give up everything. Also, I think particularly interesting that I don't think there was pretty much any mention of aliens in this movie at all, unlike the Avengers, which was obviously centered on an alien invasion. The spin-off TV show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. deals with both alien and human threats, but this movie was pretty much explicitly focused on human threats, and Zola's algorithm was this way of calculating which people were going to become threats. So that's obviously a big theme, I think, in people's discussion of the news. Our generation in particular tends to be pretty skeptical of some of these civil liberties violations that have followed the 9/11 attacks and things like that, the surveillance. But at the same time, we're also very used to having everything being photographed and having security cameras everywhere and that sort of thing. What were some of the kind of news stories that you thought of as you were watching this movie, of real world news stories that it brought to your mind?
Definitely the NSA and Edward Snowden kind of spying on us without our knowledge. WikiLeaks and the way that at the end of the movie, Cap just uploads the entire information to let the whole public know.
It's the old quote from the Supreme Court justice, sunlight is the best disinfectant. I think obviously this movie seems to come down pretty hard on the side of saying, like the Pulitzer Committee just did a couple weeks ago, of saying that the NSA's stuff should be revealed, the security state's activities should be known to the public because they shouldn't be doing it. This is not what they should be doing. That was pretty unapologetic message out of this movie. You would agree with that?
Yeah.
So do you think that this is also kind of a commentary on the audience a little bit, saying that the audience that's seeing this movie may have also been kind of suckered into this giving up freedom in exchange for security?
I mean, I don't know if all of its audience would have understood that, but it is an interesting theory.
As you mentioned, obviously the NSA, the stuff that Edward Snowden revealed, that's a big thing. Recently, and I wrote an op-ed on this myself, this allegation that the Heartbleed security vulnerability, that the NSA, they knew about it for over 2 years and didn't do anything, even though it was putting millions and millions of Americans' data and personal lives at risk. That could have been catastrophic. We saw that almost immediately after it was announced, a 19-year-old hacker got arrested in Canada for stealing like 900 some odd Canadian social security numbers during tax time because he was using this flaw. And the reason the NSA didn't tell anyone about this, which is Colonel Fury's whole thing at the beginning of this movie, is like, right, I don't have to tell you, you know, it's better if we don't tell everyone about these things. And I'm, you know, I'm going to not even tell you what everyone's assignment is on the mission, right? Mm-hmm. This ultra secretiveness. The NSA thought that if they told anyone about the vulnerability, it would get closed, and then they wouldn't be able to spy on people as easily, their targets, right? They wouldn't be able to snoop on potential terrorists or terrorist friends, get their passwords and the credit card information. They probably could have snooped on them other ways, but this made it easier using the Heartbleed vulnerability.
Right.
But that meant that they put hundreds of millions of Americans at risk in the meantime. That, to me, was particularly troubling, especially because I saw that news right after I had gone to see this movie. So I was so angry. In general, you know, I'm a big supporter of the federal government in the abstract, but I have a lot more concerns about the NSA specifically and this security state trend. I don't think it's that productive. And my personal opinion is that obviously it's horrible when people lose loved ones in an attack or are wounded in an attack, right? That's bad. But we have to weigh it outside of the abstract. There has to be a bigger context to this. Obviously, in this calculation, they make the decision, we're going to storm the Triskelion, and it's going to result in probably hundreds of lives lost there, and then everyone on the helicarriers is going to get killed. But they're weighing that against the 3 million people that are going to get annihilated if these things get in the air, right? And so they're making that calculation. But the calculation that we seem to have made since 9/11 is any life lost due to terrorism is one life too many. So we have to do all these things, go to all these extreme measures to try to prevent. And we're never going to be able to prevent those attacks. So it's kind of, it's futile, right? We're putting in these measures that still can't stop these attacks. And then in some cases are actively endangering the population in order to do these things. And then we're saying, oh, but it's for preventing terrorism. And it's like, yeah, that terrorism is bad, but the more repressive you are and the more you violate international norms, you're kind of creating this animosity in the world. Whereas if everyone had democratic open societies that were way more chill about these things, then there would be probably a lot less terrorism. Obviously, I'm not saying, you know, throw open the doors and tear down all the security measures, right? But I think there's a balance, and that's probably what's being argued for in the movie, in my opinion at least, is this idea that you've got to balance this idea, because Zola's whole thing is, you know, the Nazis tried to take everyone's freedom by force, you know, to create this secure system, and people resisted. Instead, get them to hand over their freedom willingly because they're so afraid. The price of freedom is such that sometimes there are civilian casualties, because that's an inevitable consequence, I think. And trying to prevent that completely is an effort that's going to be in vain and come at the cost of taking away everyone's freedom and personal liberties and stuff. And I'm someone who is not necessarily worried that, like, we're headed for a dystopian dictatorship or whatever, right? Despite all the YA fic that's very popular right now. I think in the abstract, it's important that people be able to have personal freedom and not be under constant surveillance, even if they're not doing anything wrong. Because I don't buy that argument that, like, oh, if you're not doing anything wrong, then, you know, what do you have to fear? And of course, right, I think Zola's algorithm takes that kind of argument to the extreme and says, well, not only have you not done anything wrong, but we know that you're going to do something wrong, and so we're going to nip it in the bud. All right, so Dan, any closing thoughts on this movie? It sounds like you'd definitely recommend it to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fun, enjoyable movie, right? But it's also one that's going to make you think.
Yeah. Just you should go see it, even though we've just given away the whole plot twists for you. It's still a fun time at the movies. It is relentless, and I think it's the most violent Marvel movie so far. Iron Man 3 had a lot of shooting and deaths in it, but this one seems to have 10 times more than that. So don't take a 5-year-old who loves Captain America, is what I'd say.
Right. I wasn't planning to see it, and a lot of people worked on me very hard, including you, to get me to go see it, and I enjoyed it. So probably most people have seen it, but part of this, I just wanted to have us discuss it after people had had a chance to see it. So again, my guest here today has been Daniel Fidler. You can follow him, Daniel_Fidler, on Twitter to get more of his pop cultural insights. Very talented guy. Dan, thanks so much for coming in to do this discussion on Captain America 2.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.